J.C. Corcoran Podcast.
It was April the 41st, being a quadruple leap year. I was driving in downtown Atlantis. My Barracuda was in the shop, so I was in a rented Stingray, and it was overheating. So I pulled into a Shell station. They said I'd blown a seal. I said, fix the damn thing and leave my private life out of it, okay, pal? While they were doing that, I walked over to a place called the Oyster Bar, a real dive. But I knew the owner. He used to play for the Dolphins. I said, hi, Gil! You have to yell, he's hard of hearing. Gil was also down on his luck. Fact is, he was barely keeping his head below water. I bellied up to the sandbar. He poured me the usual. Rusty snail, hold the grunion, shaken, not stirred. With a peanut butter and jellyfish sandwich on the side. Heavy on the mako. I slipped him a fin. On porpoise. I was feeling good. I even dropped a sand dollar in the box for Jerry's squids. For the halibut. Well, the place was crowded. We were packed in like sardines. They were all there to listen to the big band sounds of Tommy Dorsey. What soul? Tommy was rocking the place with a very popular tuna, Salmon Chanted Evening, and the stage was surrounded by screaming groupers, probably there to see the bass player. One of them was this cute little yellowtail, and she's giving me the eye. So I figured this is my chance for a little fun. You know, piece of Pisces. But she said things I just couldn't fathom. She was too deep. Seemed to be under a lot of pressure. Boy, could she drink. She drank a lot. I said, what's your sign? She said, Aquarium. I said, great! Let's get tanked. I invited her up to my place for a little midnight bait. I said, come on, baby, only take a few minnows. She threw me that same old line. Not tonight. I got a haddock. And she wasn't kidding either, because in came the biggest, meanest-looking haddock I'd ever seen come down the pike. He was covered with muscles. He came over to me and said, listen, shrimp, don't you come trolling around here. What a crab. This guy was steamed. I could see the anchor in his eyes. I turned to him, I said, abalone, you're just being shellfish. Well, I knew it was going to be trouble, and so did Gil, because he was already on the phone to the cods. The haddock hits me with a sucker punch. I catch him with a left hook. He eels over. It was a fluke, but there he was, lying on the deck, flat as a mackerel. Kelpless. I said, forget the cods, Gil. This guy's gonna need a sturgeon. Well, the yellowtail was impressed with the way I landed her boyfriend. She came over to me, she said, hey, big boy, you're really a game fish. What's your name? I said, Marlin. Well, from then on, we had a whale of a time. I took her to dinner. I took her to dance. I bought her a bouquet of flounders. And then I went home with her. And what did I get for my trouble? Case of the clams. Think I had a wet dream. Cruising through the Gulf Stream.
Now I'm just getting warmed up.
Happy to see you again.
Don't be nervous. Don't be rocky. You're a teenage guest disc jockey now.
And let me begin by wishing you a beautiful look.
Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before. It's like deja vu all over again.
Wednesday, August 3rd, 2022, 101 days remaining in our American democratic system of government, as we have known it. How you doing, kids? I'm JC. You are at jcontheline.com. Well, by now you've seen all the election results, but I will tell you this. The biggest story coming out of last night from across the country was Kansas. Very red state, very conservative state. And at one point, it was 2-1. 2-1. Now, it didn't end up quite 2-1, but it was about a 20 or 21 point differential on the state's abortion referendum. They put it on the ballot and they basically said, is it okay for us to change the state constitution to make abortion illegal? And like I said, that referendum lost by more than 20 points in the red state of Kansas. Now, does that mean that, you know, 61% or whatever it was of the people who voted against that referendum are all pro-choice? No, but it means they don't like what happened with the Supreme Court. And I think one thing that has happened since Roe v. Wade was overturned is that people figured out, hey, wait a minute, there's a lot more going on at Planned Parenthood and abortion clinics and stuff like that than we ever knew. And these ideas of women having to travel 1,000 miles just to be able to get prenatal care is ridiculous. And it is seen in a lot of places as a war against women. And I think that's pretty good news. Again, it's not so much that the referendum lost, it's that lost in Kansas. So one of the two Erics did win, and the other one was sent back home with his flamethrower. No more Eric Greitens. Eric Schmidt predictably won in the primary last night. I think there's a lot of people this morning surprised that Trudy Bush won and beat out this Kuntz guy. I think people were very surprised by that. And the rest of the stuff you either already know or will look it up if you are interested. Well, Vin Scully died last night, the age of 94, 67 years calling the Dodger games. And, you know, one of these guys who, like Ernie Harwell, like Jack Buck, were just, as Bob Costas, I would not try to pass this off on my own, but Bob Costas talked about, you know, sort of the voice and the soundtrack of your summers for 6.5 decades. Jesus. The accolades are already coming in, and deservedly so. But I will tell you, there was one story involving Vin Scully that was sort of icky. And I will tell you the story, and this is about the only thing that anybody's ever going to be able to say about Vin Scully that wasn't just glowing in terms of the assessment. It was the playoffs in 1987. Now, first of all, what you have to understand is that there are optical illusions at Major League ballparks. And at the old Busch Stadium, there was a big one. Because when you sat in the center field bleachers, let's just say you were sitting in the first row of the center field or left field bleachers, and when the place still had artificial turf and it was very bouncy out there, you would see balls bounce up off of the artificial turf in deep left center field, for example, and bounce into the crowd. And this happened in the 87 playoffs against the San Francisco Giants. Remember that? remember Jeffrey Leonard with one flap down? Oh, man. Kevin Mitchell was the left fielder for the Giants, who at Busch Stadium once was running. It was early in the game, and Mitchell was playing left field, and somebody hit like a slicing line drive into the left field corner, and Kevin Mitchell ran like a son of a gun, looked up, and the ball wasn't where he thought it was going to be, so he put up his bare hand and caught the ball barehanded. Again, this is a fly ball. I said line drive. It was somewhere in between a line drive and a fly ball. But suffice it to say, it was one of the most amazing plays I've ever seen. Guy runs like crazy. He's got a glove. That's what it's for. But when he looked up, the ball wasn't where he thought it was going to be, and just instinctively put up his bare hand and caught it on a fly. Pretty amazing. But anyhow, 1987 playoffs, and there was a play like that where one of the Giants players hit a deep fly ball to left center field, and it bounced up, and the fan in the front row of the bleachers reached out and caught the ball on one bounce. And Vin Scully described it basically as fan interference. And there was a big controversy about the whole thing. But what Vin Scully didn't know is that he was the victim of that optical illusion. Because for anybody who ever sat out there, you know, there's about 3 feet between the wall and the first row of the bleachers, meaning that it is technically impossible for anybody to reach over and commit, if you will, fan interference. It was an optical illusion. Well, it was a big stink, and people were calling for Scully's head on a stick. And he actually, in one of the only times I've ever heard of anything like this, Vin Scully had to come back on the air the next day and apologize to the fans of St. Louis and just basically say, you know, I was, because he made a big deal out of this being fan interference, and it wasn't fan interference. And after the game, they pulled him aside. Vin, I'm going to have to talk to you here because let me explain something. Yes, they showed it to him where it's physically impossible to actually lean over because of that 3-foot buffer that exists out there. But when you're watching it from behind a home plate, that's what it's look like. That's what it looks like. It's an easy mistake to make. But as I said, the accolades are coming in from all over the place. Here's one that Cardinal fans will clearly remember. Let's go back to 1985.
And how do you like this situation? The tying and possible winning runs are in scoring position with two out and Jack Clark coming up. The Herzog and his partner, Red Shandings, meanwhile, in reading, was sort of talking about walking and pitch to that blank Van Slyke. That's what he just muttered in the dugout. And I think it was a rhetorical question. Do I walk him and pitch to that so-and-so? He's not going to walk him. It is Jack Clark and Tom Niedenfuhr going head-to-head, and the ballgame on the line, and the crowd on its feet. One way or another, what a way to end. And he hits one to deep left field, and that one is gone. And Lasorda got the answer to his rhetorical question. Something about, should I walk this guy and pitch to that so-and-so? Well, he didn't walk him.
Look where the bat, all the players are. They want to make sure he touches home plate. Now they'll pick him up. They all backed off. That was a rule they made after Ozzie Smith at the home run. There was some indecision as to whether he had touched home plate, so Daniel made sure.
Look at who was out there at home plate, Vince Coleman.
Oh,
number 29.
Everybody's going to be out there.
You would think that the face would be a little kinder to one man in such a short amount of time.
That's as slow a trip as Jack Clark ever made. I mean, he takes a lot of time.
There's McGee.
Look at Socia just kneeling in disbelief.
Pedro Guerrero saw what was going to happen, just took off his glove and threw it straight down. Lasorda was so pissed off. He really hated Andy Van Slyke. He did not like Van Slyke, that so-and-so. Oh, God. The U-Man and I were there for that because we were broadcasting live from the Cardinals Hotel in Los Angeles, and we went to the game, and we were sitting there watching this right in front of our two eyes. We couldn't even believe it. We ended up taking a red eye back. I remember getting back at like, I don't know, like 6:30 in the morning and driving along going, wow. Can't believe what just happened. And I have one other thing, too, that I found here. And it involves Glenn Frey from the Eagles.
So the first thing to do with Glenn is to make sure he's relaxed. And if he is relaxed so that he can enjoy the luxury of silence, let the crowd roar. Don't be afraid not to be speaking. That'll be the first thing. If he gets over that, I think he'll be all right.
Well, here we go, Ben.
Well, you have Sachs and Duncan and Landreau. No score, bottom of the third inning. Let's see what happens.
Well, nothing much happened at all until Pedro Guerrero came up with two out and one on.
Guerrero's just been tearing the cover off the ball. How many home runs this month?
Well, he has 15 home runs, and he has 11 since they moved him from third base to center field.
The windup and the pitch. Oh, it's gone. Is it gone? It's back. It's back. Cruz at the warning track. He can't get it. It's gone. A two-run homer for Pedro Guerrero. And it's a 2-0 Dodger lead.
Calling a Pedro Guerrero homer when you're sitting next to Vin Scully has got to be exciting. Still, there's another aspect of baseball that thrills Glenn just as much.
To have one of your songs be cut to sports footage is really gratifying. I think it's, it's fabulous to hear the heat is on when, it's 90 degrees out and the bases are loaded. That's great.
The heat is on.
Like I always say, we want to be them, they want to be us. Glenn Frey can be on stage in front of 60,000 people in some giant arena of some sort outside, you know, playing the Rose Bowl or something like that. But in the back of his mind, he's thinking, I'd really love to call a baseball game. And then you're sitting next to Vin Scully. All right, I said that was the last one. While the other one was playing, I found this one. And this is very, very cool, and you may not have heard this. It's when Scully was presented the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
With a voice that transcended a sport and transformed a profession, Vin Scully narrated America's pastime for generations of fans. Known to millions as the soundtrack of summer, he found time to teach us about life and love while chronicling routine plays and historic heroics. In victory and in defeat, his colorful accounts reverberated through the bleachers, across the airwaves, and into our homes and imaginations. He is an American treasure and a beloved storyteller, and our country's gratitude for Vin Scully is as profound as his love for the game.
Well, you know, we've talked about this. We're going to lose everybody over about the course of the next 10 years or so. We're going to lose everybody. Tom Petty is already gone. Super Dave is already gone. Bowie is already gone. I don't even want to continue. It's too depressing to talk about. Miami Dolphins owner got suspended for 6 weeks for impermissible communications with Tom Brady and a former Saints coach. It's called tampering. Now, I'm the last one to talk about this, okay? Because my wife is 22 years younger than me. My first wife was 11 years younger than me. And even people sort of went, whoo, when I told them that. But then you marry somebody who's 22 years younger. I didn't go out looking for a woman who was 22 years younger than me. It just sort of happened. You can't control who you meet and who you end up falling in love with and marrying. It just sort of happens, okay? But when I met my wife, I was 52 and she was 30. I think by the time you're 30 years old, you're capable of making a decision for yourself. I bring this up because Dane Cook is 50 and he is engaged to his longtime love, Kelsey Taylor, who is 23. Now that gap is starting to get a little uncomfortable, but it's most uncomfortable when you realize that they've been dating since she was 18. And he was 40. That's getting into a weird area. Big difference between a woman being 30 and being 18 when a guy who's a generation older than her comes along and says, hey, baby, how about you and me? But most disturbing about this whole story is not the age difference. It's that somebody is marrying Dane Cook. That fucking guy has never made me laugh once. Speaking of age, there's a thread online right now where people are talking about the oldest celebrities they still find attractive, like Viggo Mortensen is 63, Jane Seymour, 71, Cassandra Peterson, that is Elvira, she turns 71 next month, Susanna Hoffs of the Bengals, now we're talking, she is so, so pretty, and she's 63. Who else we got here? Sally Field, 75. Susan Sarandon, 75. Stanley Tucci. That one I could see, too. If I were a woman, I think I'd find him attractive. 61. Julie Andrews is 86. Dolly Parton, 76. Jeff Bridges is 72. Pierce Brosnan, 69. Helen Mirren, 77. And Salma Hayek. And she's 55. Deborah Harry is 77. Harrison Ford is 80. Tom Selleck, 77. He wants your house, by the way. George Clooney, 61. George Clooney is going to be handsome until they're going to be pumping embalming fluid into him. And people are going to still say, it's a good-looking guy right there. But it was Martin Mull who made the observation years ago. He said, it's really not fair when you stop to think that as men get to an advanced age, they have a tendency to look like Sean Connery. And when women get to an advanced age, they tend to look like Sean Connery. There's two schools of thought on remaking iconic movies. One is that, well, if you're going to make a good movie, start with something that was a good movie and then remake it. The other rule, though, is the opposite. And it's like, look, no, don't try to make an iconic movie over again 20, 30, 40 years later. It's just a bad idea. I mention that because Selena Gomez is producing a reboot of Working Girl. The original came out in 88. Melanie Griffith, Sigourney Weaver, Joan Cusack, and Harrison Ford. The movie expected to premiere on Hulu. So it's not really a movie. It's just a TV show disguised as a movie. I posted this meme from Jimmy Fallon from last night is they do this bit every once in a while where they say, let's put out like 4 or 5 ideas for tweets. And then the audience votes. And the one that gets the most responses, they actually put it out on Twitter. And the one that won last night, when you're holding a bowling ball, your 3 fingers must be like, where are we? Internet ablaze with people voicing their opinions about the Harrison Bader trade for the Yankees. It's going to be interesting when the Yankees are here this weekend and Harrison Bader comes trotting out. If he's even suiting up, and he's got that plantar fasciitis, which I had a long time ago, and it is painful. I had it for, oh my gosh, I'm going to say it was the better part of 2 years. I remember Jose Oquendo had it too, back in his playing days, you know. And it is painful. And even if you say to yourself, I'm just going to play through the pain, it's so bad that you think that you're able to sort of overcome it with mind over matter. You can't. You can't do it. It hurts too much. But Mozeliak, I remember at the beginning of the season him talking about trying to get more offensive production out of the center field position, and that must have been the beginning of the end for Harrison Bader, and I don't think anybody thought that Dylan Carlson would be able to cover the amount of ground and play as well defensively as he has been playing. It's just shocking, because you lose Harrison Bader to injury, and it's like, all right, put Dylan Carlson out there. Let's see what happens. And he's great out there. And again, apparently they told him on Sunday that the trade wasn't going to happen involving Juan Soto because everybody wanted Dylan Carlson. Apparently the Washington Nationals were told over the weekend, no, we're not giving him up. And once they said we're not giving up Dylan Carlson, Washington said, well, then we're going to go in another direction. Now, we didn't know any of that until last night, but that's apparently what happened. And I'm fine with this whole thing. I really am. I'm fine with it. I had the same response. We've been talking about this. I had the same response on the Albert Pujols thing. It's like, okay, yeah, he's a great player and everything, but his skills are going to diminish, and you're tying up all of this money, hundreds of millions of dollars, over the course of the next 10 years, and it's going to financially disable your franchise for an entire decade. So I'm fine with what happened. Now, let's take all those hundreds of millions of dollars that were apparently on the table for Juan Soto and go get some pitching, okay? Everybody remember Edie McClurg? She was in all the John Hughes movies. She had the incredible scene with Steve Martin at the car rental place and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. She was in Ferris Bueller's Day Off as the assistant to the principal. Oh, he's very popular, Ed. She is now, I think it's 77 years old, and some dude who's a lot younger than her is trying to marry her, and I guess family members and stuff like that are going, this whole thing stinks, and now they're accusing the guy of sexual abuse on top of it. Apparently, she is in the early stages of dementia, doesn't really fully understand everything that is going on, and so I guess we'd say watch this space. And I'm getting one off the bucket list tonight. I have never seen Todd Rundgren in concert. And it has been, let's see, it was 1981 the last time I saw Hall & Oates open for the Electric Light Orchestra in Omaha, Nebraska, back in 1981. So tonight, it's Daryl Hall and Todd Rundgren. And Daryl Hall does a set, and then Todd Rundgren does a set. And then they come out and they do a set together. There's a version of I Saw the Light, the Todd Rundgren song, with those two exchanging lyrics. And it is absolutely fantastic. I'll have a full report on your desk in the morning. We're living in a weird era right now where intelligence and education is being devalued. Now, I agree. There's some people who are not college material, and there's nothing wrong with that. Look, when my fucking air conditioner is broken, I need somebody who went to a trade school who can crawl up there and fix the darn thing and get the house back to a nice, comfortable temperature, okay? That guy may or may not have gone to college. I got no problem with that. Not everybody needs to be going to college. And I've often said that the best part and the most important part of college, and this is where I sort of disagree with the idea that not everybody should go to college. I just think more people should go than are going right now. 73% of people say college isn't just about learning a new job or job skills. It's about learning to be an adult. Schoolwork was named the hardest aspect of college, but it barely beat out the next three: learning how to manage your time, having more responsibilities, and living on your own. 85% of people who've gone to college say it helped prepare them for real life. The top things they picked up were organizational skills and figuring out what they're passionate about. Now, I lived on the southwest side of Chicago. We only saw black people once a year during our baseball tournament, and they would bring in the black kids from the projects to play against us. And you're like, you know, 11, 12, 13 years old, and you really have never seen people of color other than in a sports arena, and there they are. And you're just watching every move they make because they seemed so different. They talked different. They looked different. Their mannerisms were different. They even played different. They played really well, as a matter of fact. They just didn't have the kind of organizational training and stuff like that. So you had a lot of raw talent out there, but the raw talent wasn't being harvested right, and the guys were probably not being coached right, so they were underperforming. And I remember thinking in later life that's such a shame, because a lot of these guys probably would have been champions, but they just didn't have the organizational stuff. And this is when you're, you know, 11, 12 years old, and you're sort of watching all this stuff. I mention that because it wasn't until I went away to college that I was, you know, living on the same floor with and sharing bathrooms with and becoming friends with people of color. And it wasn't just color either. It was socioeconomic differences. It was the first time I ever met a kid who grew up on a farm. First time I ever really encountered Jewish people on a mass basis, and we had a lot of them at Northern Illinois University because they came out of the northern Chicago suburbs, like, you know, Skokie and places like that. I was exposed to all sorts of stuff that I never would have been, even at the campus radio station. You meet people who have a completely different background than you do, wanting to talk about different things, wanting to play different kinds of music. You started becoming aware of the lives that people came from before they got to college, and it wasn't always very pretty. I took a course in black literature, all these incredible novels written by black authors, and sort of exposing, if you will, the black lifestyle. You read books like Black Like Me. White guy got an injection of some sort so that it changed his pigmentation from white to black. And so you have a white guy now down in the deep south, and he wrote an entire book about his experience. Asian people. I don't think I'd ever known an Asian kid. As a white kid growing up in the white part of the south side of Chicago, I still remember Steve Fukuda. It was the 70s, and we were still very intolerant of gays back then. I mean, the way we treated two gay guys on our floor was just absolutely despicable. But you didn't dare part from the herd mentality, because you yourself would have gotten blacklisted, if you will. And so you just had to sort of like pretend that you didn't like them either. And you didn't dare even get caught talking to one of them. It was horrible. It was really, really horrible. I'm ashamed of myself. If I had been the man I am today back then, it would have been a completely different situation. But you know what? You live, you learn, and you grow. And that is the crux of the matter here. Yeah, you got to pick out a career, you got to get a degree, and you got to get through 4 years of college, but you learn about the world and you learn about people different from you. And so sometimes people who went to college look down their noses at people that did not, and it's not necessarily about the education. I feel sorry for people who didn't have that experience. There's a lot of people in radio who never went to college, and I mean a lot. I would say the overwhelming majority, as a matter of fact, which is weird because eventually you end up in a situation where you got to start talking. But as I'm saying all this, I think to myself, I know just as many bigots who went to college and never learned a goddamn thing about life, about people, and about things that were different than the experience that you have had up until that point in life. It's like the old saying, walk a mile in my shoes. If you've never had the opportunity to talk to somebody, to be a friend of somebody who looks different than you, you're just missing a big part of life. And don't get me wrong, because I've had some real asshole black guys too, and women. Oh man. And in that case, you know, you can't really do too much about it, because then you'll be accused of being a racist. And it's like, it's got nothing to do with your skin. It's got to do with what you say and the way you act and the way you treat people. And you're an asshole. And you'd be an asshole if your skin was white or yellow or whatever. It's got nothing to do with your skin color. Life is hard, man. Life is hard. All right, late night tonight, Kevin Bacon on with Jimmy Fallon. Colbert's got Ron Howard and James Taylor again. And it says here that Seth Meyers is going to have a new show, but I don't know about that. You know, he's been out with COVID. Birthdays today, Ryan Lochte, swimmer and liar, 38. Tom Brady, Tampa Bay badass, 45. James Hetfield from Metallica, 59. John C. McGinley, one of the Bobs in Office Space. And Dr. Cox on Scrubs. John C. McGinley, 63. John Landis, director of Animal House, Blues Brothers, An American Werewolf in London, Trading Places, Coming to America, and the Michael Jackson Thriller video. John Landis, 72. Martha Stewart, Caged Heat, 81. Martin Sheen, one of the coolest guys I've ever gotten a chance to talk to, is 82. Tony Bennett is 96. 38 years ago today, 1984, Mary Lou Retton wins the gold medal in the individual all-around event in women's gymnastics at the Olympics in L.A. I did an interview with her subsequently. She admitted to me that she won her gold medal before she ever had her first period. There's a guy by the name of Jeff Skunk Baxter. Music fans know who he is. He was with Steely Dan and then joined the Doobie Brothers. He's also a defense consultant who specializes in missile defense. Jeff Skunk Baxter is touring right now, and people always ask him, what's the Jeff Skunk Baxter? And in an interview, he told me that it was, and these were his words, youthful indiscretions, which I assume meant he would fart a lot and get laughs out of it, but he did not specify. And newly unsealed court documents reveal that Amber Heard's lawyers claimed Johnny Depp suffered from erectile dysfunction. I don't know if I believe that. After all, he was in Ed Wood. And with that, the J.C. Corcoran podcast for Wednesday, August 3rd, 2022. 101 days remaining in our American democratic system of government. As we have known it, we're here every weekday morning just after 7 o'clock at jcontheline.com. Please spread the word. You can email me, jc@jcontheline.com. The Facebook is the showgram with J.C. Corcoran. That's it. Have a great day. Stay dry. Stay cool. And in the meantime, we've beaten this one to death. Have a good one. See you later. Bye.